Welcome to today's Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American, read by volunteers at the Recording Library of West Texas. This production is also available at recordinglibrary.org and on the telephone reader by calling 432-617-5555.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, January 16th, 2020. Front page. Many investors think Permian output will rise at slower rate. One Canadian investor thinks Permian production will peak in 2020. By Simon Casey, Bloomberg. Such is the extent of the shakeout in the U.S. shale industry that Permian Basin oil production is closer to peaking than many forecasts suggest, according to one energy investor. Adam Waterous, who runs Waterous Energy Fund, regards the sector's financial position as unsustainable after years of disappointing returns for investors and negative free cash flow. With capital markets now largely shunning shale producers, the impact will begin to show in oil and natural gas output from the largest U.S. oil patch. "We think we are at or near peak Permian production," Waterous said last week in an interview. "The North American oil market has been grossly overcapitalized, which is not sustainable." Predicting peak Permian output for 2020 isn't a mainstream view. There's plenty of debate about how much production growth in the West Texas and New Mexico patch may slow this year as shale drillers slash capital spending. But the consensus is that supplies will rise, albeit at a slower pace. Ty Liu, an analyst at Bloomberg NEF, said in a report Tuesday that the pessimism may be overdone. Such considerations have global ramifications, as the U.S. is expected to account for a large portion of worldwide supply growth this year. As head of investment banking at Bank of Nova Scotia, Waterous had a direct hand in mergers and acquisitions that reshaped the energy sector. But he says the model these deals represented, one in which oil and gas companies prioritized production gains and M&A, is now a relic. "The capital gains model is broken," he said. "The M&A market is gone, and it's not coming back." The kind of industry rationalization Waterous describes may work to his advantage. His Calgary-based private equity firm, which he founded in 2017, controls two Canadian oil producers. One of them, Kona Resources Limited, agreed to buy Pengrowth Energy Corp. in November for $21 million, after Pengrowth's share price cratered as the company buckled under a huge debt load. Waterous Energy is looking for more assets in Canada and the U.S. Waterous likens the plight of U.S. shale in recent years to the five stages of grief. The first stage, denial, is characterized by a belief that the M&A market will return. That's followed by anger, the market is wrong, then bargaining by trying to operate within cash flow, followed by depression, moving to the free cash flow model that many shale operators have been touting. The final stage, acceptance, is defined by Waterous as the industry finally resolving to provide investors with cash payouts via dividends so that they recover their initial investments. Over the past 5 years, the industry and its investors mistook a massive structural change for a simple cyclical event, he said. "It's impossible to continue to have uneconomic production and capex." Big Spring Council tentatively okays Sanctuary City Ordinance. By Edgar Walters, Texas Tribune. Three Texas towns recently voted in favor of anti-abortion ordinances, extending the reach of a campaign to create sanctuary cities for the unborn across the state. The city councils of Big Spring and Colorado City with populations around 28,000 and 4,000 respectively, voted Tuesday for a version of the controversial ordinance, which started popping up in small towns in East Texas last year. The ordinance aims to outlaw abortion if the U.S. Supreme Court makes it possible to do so. It also grants family members of women who have abortions the ability to sue the provider for emotional distress. Big Spring's vote was tentative. A majority of city council members will need to vote once more in favor of the ordinance for it to pass. Colorado City's vote, which also banned the sale of emergency contraception such as Plan B, was final, making it the eighth local government with such an ordinance in effect, according to the anti-abortion group pushing them. The East Texas town of Rusk approved a similar ordinance last week. The ordinances are of contested legality and enforceability. The American Civil Liberties Union has said it is investigating a possible lawsuit seeking to strike them down. Three towns, Mineral Wells, Omaha, and Jacksboro, have voted down similar ordinances or walked them back under advice from city attorneys. But that hasn't discouraged Mark Lee Dixon, the traveling anti-abortion activist who hopes to galvanize a statewide movement and perhaps provoke a lawsuit that could change abortion law nationwide. "We have every intention of targeting every part of the state," said Dixon, who said he is traveling to Levland this week in hopes of persuading the town west of Lubbock to adopt a similar ordinance. "Every city, no matter what size, is valuable." Abortion rights advocates say the local ordinances are dangerous and intentionally confusing because they may lead people to believe falsely that abortion is illegal. The strategy of bringing the abortion fight to the local level has divided even the staunchest anti-abortion activists. Some groups, including the Texas Alliance for Life, have warned against taking an inflammatory approach that is unlikely to survive a legal contest and could set the anti-abortion movement back in court. Most provisions of the ordinance would not take effect unless U.S. Supreme Court issues a new opinion on the legality of abortion. "Congressional Candidates Struggle to Stand Out," by Caitlin Randall, C-R-A-N-D-L-E, at MRT.com. The next representative of Texas's 11th Congressional District likely will be decided in the March primary. And with that probability looming, the nine Republican candidates in the running struggled to pull away from the pack Wednesday at a forum hosted by Ector County Republican Women at Odessa Country Club. Following two-minute opening statements, moderator Jay Hendricks of KOSA-TV asked the candidates to raise their hands if they support the Second Amendment. The nine men raised their hands. Hendricks continued, asking the candidates if they support the border wall, term limits, pro-life issues, immigration reform, President Trump, and are against red flag laws. All nine raised their hands after each prompt. They continued to agree on most issues for the next hour and a half. When asked how they would work with Democrats in Congress, including House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they said they would not. "I won't," said Wesley Verdell of Brady. "It's that simple." Robert Tucker of Comanche said, "You can't compromise with the devil." And former Midland Councilman J. Ross Lacey said he had zero desire to work with Pelosi, Ocasio-Cortez, and the Squad. Hendricks then asked the candidates how they would address the country's mental health crisis, saying many of them have previously attributed mass shootings to undiagnosed mental health issues. Tucker and Verdell said mental health legislation should be passed on the state level. Lacey made a case for opening more state-run mental health facilities, and Ned Luscombe of Gardendale blamed the issue on the abundance of antidepressants such as Prozac, saying Big Pharma is a large portion of what causes mass shootings. Candidates are listed in the order they will appear on the March primary ballot. Brandon Batch. Batch, a Midlander, focused on his time spent as a policy advisor for U.S. Representative Michael McCaul. He told the Reporter-Telegram previously that he was born in Odessa and adopted by a Midland family when his mom died, and he viewed running for Congress as a way to contribute to the community that took him in, a point he reiterated Wednesday. "This community gave me so much growing up, so I can consider it an honor to have this opportunity to give back." Batch said he believes education is the most important issue facing the U.S., and that educators don't receive the support they need. Robert Tucker, a self-described strict constitutionalist, mainly spoke about limiting the powers of the federal government. He said the American people shouldn't be slaves to our federal government. "We've got to get this government back to the position it was when our founders founded it," he said. August Pfluger of San Angelo spotlighted his time serving in the U.S. Air Force as a security advisor to Trump. "I've worked in Washington, but not in the swamp," he said. "I will hit the ground running on day one with 20 years of experience." He said he believes securing the U.S. border with Mexico should be the country's primary focus. Jamie Berryhill said he's been a resident of Odessa for 62 years and has been creating businesses in the city for 40. As the president of religious organization Mission Messiah, he spent much of his allotted time speaking in favor of pro-life values and discussing the spiritual war he believes the country is in. Wesley Verdell said he was running because Congress is broken and in need of a true conservative. He said his main concern is federal regulation on the oil industry. He also said the House impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump was investigating the wrong person, and time should be spent investigating former Vice President Joe Biden. J. Ross Lacey highlighted his oil and gas experience as president of Lacey Oil Corporation, as well as his 6 years serving on the Midland City Council. He said his focus would be ensuring that the country remains energy independent and fighting against liberal Democrats. "I want to go stand with President Trump and fight back against the liberal Democrats and the liberal media," he said. Additionally, he said he was in favor of abolishing the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency because the oil and gas industry takes care of itself. Ned Luscombe said he was running because there's some crazy folk in Washington, referring to Democrats. He said Congress needs folks who will play hardball with Democrats, and he views his lack of political experience as a positive. "I have knocked on thousands of doors. I've talked to thousands of people. People say they do not want a politician or someone who has spent time in Washington to be their next congressman." He added that he was the oldest in the group and probably the saltiest. Casey Gray, who is from Odessa, spoke about his military experience, saying he's been deployed 18 times since the age of 17. "I'm the only wounded warrior up here," he said. He said he's had 24 reconstructive surgeries. He said his primary concerns were the district's energy independence and securing the U.S.-Mexico border. J.D. Faircloth, the former Midland mayor, said his focus was on the country being fiscally conservative. "I believe the most serious threat facing our country is skyrocketing national debt." An accountant, he said, "I understand debt. I know we cannot continue to outspend our revenue." National Weather Service. 2010s was the warmest decade in Midland. By Stuart Doreen. S-D-O-R-E-E-N at MRT.com. The past decade was the warmest in history in the city of Midland. The National Weather Service reports that the average temperature during the decade at Midland International Airport, 65.9 degrees, was not only 2 degrees higher than the average annual temperature, but also was more than 1.5 degrees higher than the previous warmest decade, 2000 to 2009. The top ranking will not likely be a surprise to many, as the NWS also reported 6 of the 7 warmest years on record at Midland International came from 2010 to 2019. The final 4 years were all among the warmest 7, including the warmest, 67.5 degrees, in 2017. The Associated Press reported Wednesday that the most recent decade was by far the hottest ever measured on Earth, capped off by the second warmest year on record. Worldwide, the 2010s averaged 58.4 degrees, or 1.4 degrees higher than the 20th century average, and more than one-third of a degree warmer than the previous decade, which had been the hottest on record, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The decade had 8 of the 10 hottest years on record worldwide, according to the AP report. Obituaries and death notices. Charles Gronow passed from this life on December 9, 2019, with many of his loved ones by his side. He was preceded in death by his wife Frances, parents Carl and Rachel, and daughter Sherry. He is survived by daughters Elizabeth Boyd of Gardendale, Cindy Bowden of Electra, Linda Woolfolk of Comanche, Susan of Lindale, and son Brian of Athens. He is also survived by 13 grandchildren. Charles is also survived by many great-grandchildren, a sister, and many friends. A celebration of life service is scheduled on Saturday, January 18th at 11 a.m. at Crestview Baptist Church. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations be made to the Crestview Baptist Church Forward by Faith Building Fund or other charitable organization. Frankie Elizabeth Clarkson, 83, of Midland, passed away on Monday, January 13th, surrounded by her family. The family will receive friends on Thursday, January 16th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Nellie Pickelin Welch Funeral Home in Midland. Funeral service will be held on Friday, January 17th at 2 p.m. at St. Nicholas Episcopal Church. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. She was born on January 10th, 1937 to Marion Truman White in El Monte, California. She is survived by her husband Walter, her daughters Cassandra Richardson, Elizabeth Roddy, and 6 grandchildren, 1 niece, and 2 great-grandchildren. She is preceded in death by her sons Roger, Charles, and her sister Penny. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickelin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.mpwelch.com. Mary Louise Wells Fisher passed away on January 14th in Houston. Mary was born December 27th, 1930, in Everett, Washington, to John and Anna Wells. She is preceded in death by her husband of 53 years and son Quinn, her father, her mother, her sisters, and her brother, Colonel John H. Wells. She is survived by her daughter Lurla and Jim Noki of Monahans, 11 grandchildren and 12 great-grandchildren. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, January 17th at Sunset Funeral Home. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Saturday, January 18th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home Chapel, with Greg Fleming officiating. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. To send family condolences, please sign her guest book at www.sunsetodessa.com. Robert Ralph Truett, Jr. was born January 21, 1948, near Roswell, New Mexico, to Robert and Dorothy Truett. He was preceded in death by his youngest brother, Steve. He is survived by his parents, his son Patrick, his daughter Maureen Patterson, 1 granddaughter, 2 nephews. Robert's ashes will be scattered in a private family service at the Frontier Cemetery on their ranch at Stephenville. In lieu of flowers, please make donations to the charity of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickelin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.mpwelch.com. Vida Angel Pinkston was born December 3, 1924, in Courtney, Texas, and passed away on January 13th in Tyler. Vida is preceded in death by her parents, her sisters, and her husband, Bill. She is survived by her daughter, Brenda, and son-in-law, Jay, her daughter, Janice, and son, Pat Pinkston, and daughter-in-law, Carol, 9 grandchildren, 12 great-grandchildren. Visitation will be from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday, January 17th, at Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home in Midland. Services will be held at First Baptist Church Stanton at 10 a.m. on Saturday, January 18th. Interment will be at Evergreen Cemetery in Stanton. The family suggests that memorial donations be made to the Alzheimer's Association or First Baptist Church in Stanton. Online condolences may be made at www.mpwelch.com. The Opinion Page. Guest View from the Dallas Morning News. Governor Abbott offers hope and redemption to sex slaves in Texas. If it's possible for news to come crackling across the internet, that's what happened on Saturday when Governor Greg Abbott issued a full pardon to Robbie Ann Hamilton. Robbie is someone who will be familiar to readers of these pages. The resident of Richardson was a victim of human trafficking who committed a few petty crimes well over a decade ago, during a period in her life when she was addicted to drugs and being exploited by others. She was the subject of a lengthy profile we published in 2018 about her descent into life as a trafficking victim and her long journey back to a life of personal freedom from abuse and addiction. With this pardon, Governor Abbott has done more than wash clean the criminal record of one person. In a series of editorials, we've encouraged the governor to use the power of clemency to put the fight against sex trafficking on a sound moral foundation. And that is what he has done here. Through this offer of mercy, the governor has also signaled to every victim of sex trafficking that absolution is possible. And when there is absolution, when there is redemption, it is possible for victims to cast off the burden of shame and take up the mantle of a free person. In his statement announcing this pardon, the governor noted a few parameters that we've encouraged as well when pushing for such clemency. It's important and significant that Robbie's crimes didn't harm another person and that she has since worked to turn her life around. It's critical that a pardon doesn't rob a person of his or her humanity or their moral agency, even as it offers a fresh start. But it's equally important that society at large send a signal to those being exploited by traffickers that there is hope. There is a life outside the clutches of those who are perpetrating crimes against them and against all of us. And that when a person does the work necessary to build anew, we, as a society, will stand beside them and shoulder some of the load. With a stroke of his pen, the governor struck a moral blow against human trafficking, raised the light of hope to tens of thousands of people in Texas who have been trafficked, and sent a signal to traffickers that the governor has taken a personal interest in undoing and combating the crimes they are engaged in. We hope that with this pardon, Robbie feels a weight lifted from her shoulders and that a new weight is placed on the backs of every human trafficker who will hear news of this crackle across their newsfeed. It is they who should feel the extra burden of shame, of guilt, and of fear that in this life or the next, justice will reach them. And when it does, it's not absolution that it will bring.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Weekender section of the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Thursday, January 16th. Flatland Cavalry's frontman finds growth in band's new chapter. The story was written by Rich Lopez. For those familiar with Flatland Cavalry's story, it begins with frontman and songwriter Clito Cordero's accidental songwriting. When he was 17 and a student at Lee High School, Cordero penned his first song without any particular inspiration. A decade later, he and his band are on the road with its second album, 2019's Homeland Insecurity. Quote, "It's funny. Our date back in Midland will be the one-year anniversary of the album's release," he said in a phone interview. Flatland Cavalry returns to Midland for a headlining concert at La Hacienda Event Center on Saturday. Formerly based in Lubbock, the band now calls Fort Worth home. Since his 2016 debut, Humble Folks, the band has been on the road. But when they head back to West Texas, Cordero says it will be a little more special. Quote, "I've grown so much, but this place is a part of me," he said. "Me and the drummer, Jason Albers, are from Midland. There's this sense of nostalgia coming back home that I don't even want to get rid of. To see old friends come out, it regrounds you," end quote. But a move to the big city denotes part of Flatland Cavalry's new chapter. For the first album, they were mostly still college students. The Texas Tech alum describes the band's members as big kids. Quote, "We've definitely grown into the real world and learning these lessons. The real world is our classroom, and I think we have a more mature perception of any daily struggles," he said. This can be heard in the country band's second album, which showcases a strong writing style with instrumentation that is both delicate and rock solid. Homeland Insecurity is establishing the band's foundation with substance that gave Flatland Cavalry the number one Texas radio hit, Old School. Quote, "It's always nice to know that our music is being listened to and that our hard work and the stories we crafted are understood," he said. "It's kind of a reassurance that not deciding to be an accountant wasn't a bad idea," end quote. Although he knew back in high school that music would be part of his life after this first song, he pursued an accounting degree at Tech. Quote, "My parents are extremely hardworking and came from humble beginnings, so they wanted all their kids to get an education," he said. "My brother told me to go into accounting because I could get a job in any city and still pursue music at night. I knew in my heart music was what I wanted to do, but the degree was something to do while pursuing it, and my parents had been supportive from day one," end quote. Cordero adds that it's what the band stands for. Quote, "We're about following your heart and seeing where it leads. We're trying to figure out who we are as individuals and together, and seeing what's in us and pulling that out for the world," end quote. If you go, Flatland Cavalry, 8 p.m. Saturday, La Hacienda Event Center, 12610 State Highway 191, tickets are $20. Go online at haciendamidland.com. Here is the Reporter Telegram Weekender's Heat Index. Today, Basin Strong, a collective of oil and gas industry executives and community leaders, hosts the Hope and Healing Concert at La Hacienda Event Center, benefiting the families and victims of the August 31st mass shooting, in which 7 people were killed and 25 were injured. Headlined by country singer Clay Walker, the concert will also feature Rick Trevino as the opening act. Proceeds from the show will be donated to the Odessa Community Foundation's August 31st Fund. Tickets can be purchased for the concert only or for concert and dinner by the Chuck Wagon. Doors open at 5:30 p.m. with the concert scheduled at 7 p.m. Visit basinstrong.com for tickets. On Friday, nightclub dance floors in Midland are largely geared toward country and Latin music fans, but leave out fans of pop and dance music, past and present. Where does one dance to some retro hits or today's sounds? The Ox Dance Bar and Nightclub is looking to answer that question. The new club celebrates its grand opening with dance band West Texas Funk, and DJ Fluis will spin the tunes. Doors open at 8 p.m. On Saturday, theater fans are invited to enjoy some cake at the Maverick Players' birthday event at the VFW Post 4149. Both original and new core members of the Maverick Players will share stories about the company's tenure and mission to stage comedies that are also new shows to area audiences. Its theater home is now the Hall at the V, where the Mavericks produce a show for spring and fall each year. The party lasts from 4 until 7 p.m. Saturday. On Sunday, An American in Paris stars Gene Kelly as an American ex-GI making a living as a painter in Paris. Two women have their sights set on him for entirely different reasons. Lisa is charming and delicate, but Milo is rich and can help his career. The movie was directed by Vincent Vanelli with music by George Gershwin. Winner of 6 Oscars, including Best Picture, TCM Big Screen Classics brings the film back to the movies at Regal Tall City with 2 showings at 1 and 4 p.m. and another at 7 p.m. Wednesday. This is the Dear Abby column that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, January 16th. Man disabled as a teen is haunted by parents' inaction. Dear Abby, when I was a junior in high school, I sustained a neck injury at school that damaged my spinal cord. I recovered mostly from that, but I have residual weakness in my right side and severe neck pain. I was able to work until, at 57, I had to go on disability. Because of that, my financial situation is difficult, increasingly so now that my wife will be retiring. At the time of my injury, my parents didn't sue the school, although clearly the school was responsible. I was too young and certainly in no shape to address the situation. A lawyer approached my parents at that time, and my physician stated my injuries would limit my long-term work abilities and drastically affect my life. My parents were aware that I would have limited work years, thus affecting my financial situation. I feel anger toward them because of their inaction regarding my injury and not suing the school. I see them once or twice a week, and I'm wondering if I should bring this up to them now. They are in their mid-80s, but are quite lively and take care of themselves. It consumes my thoughts each time I visit them, but I've said nothing. Do you think I should bring this up to them? Signed, Injured in Tennessee. Dear Injured, yes, I do. You deserve to know why they were so apathetic in taking care of your welfare, and they should be made aware of the impact it has had on your life. It may be too late to sue the school for what happened to you, but at least you will have some answers. Dear Abby, I am suffering from postpartum depression while trying to reconcile with my husband Derek. He had several emotional affairs during my recent pregnancy, as well as after I gave birth. His parents attacked me about the postpartum. I was hospitalized for a week because of it, but they said it was an act. Recently, his mom texted him saying he should use my mental illness as grounds to divorce me. I texted her, asking her to stop attacking me that way. She responded, calling me a devil, saying she's always hated me. Now she's turning his entire family against me, spreading vicious lies. She even accused me of trying to sleep with my father-in-law, which Derek knows is ridiculous. I have asked Derek to address the situation, but what else can I do? I'm no longer comfortable around his parents or sending my children to be around them. I don't want Derek to be in an awkward position, but it's not fair for me to be attacked with malicious lies because of her jealousy, especially 12 years in. Please help. Signed, Disrespected in Illinois. Dear Disrespected, you may be suffering from postpartum, but your mother-in-law appears to have more problems than you do. I don't envy you for being her target, or your husband for having to buffer you. It may be helpful if the two of you consult a licensed mental health provider to figure out how to deal with her, if that's possible. And Derek should waste no time letting the rest of the family know that none of what his mother is saying is true. Texas law protecting armed churchgoers draws national attention. This was written by Abigail Hausloner, Deanna Paul, and Kim Belware from the Washington Post via the Texas Tribune. Top Texas officials on Monday cited the actions of several armed churchgoers who subdued a gunman in their sanctuary this weekend as a model of how Americans should protect themselves from potential mass shooters. The attack, after which two church members and the gunman were dead, came 2 years after the Texas legislature passed a law that authorized anyone with a concealed carry license to bring their weapon into houses of worship. That law was a response to the 2017 attack on a church in Sutherland Springs that left 26 people dead before a local resident shot the gunman outside the building and forced him to flee. The shooter, who attacked West Freeway Church of Christ in White Settlement, a suburb of Fort Worth, on Sunday, was killed by a single shot from church member Jack Wilson, a former reserve sheriff's deputy and Army veteran. Wilson, who owns a shooting range in nearby Granbury, said he started training fellow members to be a part of the church's volunteer security team when it launched after the Texas law passed. Quote, "If there was any church in the state, in America, that was prepared for this, it was this church," Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, a Republican, said at a news conference Monday. Continuing the quote, "They had done their training, and I think that you could see it in the results," end quote. He credited the new law with making the armed congregants' quick responses possible, calling it a model of what other churches and other places of business need to focus on. President Donald Trump weighed in Monday evening, tweeting that the attack, quote, "was over in 6 seconds, thanks to the brave parishioners who acted to protect 242 fellow worshipers. Lives were saved by these heroes and Texas laws allowing them to carry arms," end quote. But other state leaders took issue with Trump and Paxton's interpretation of the incident. Former Texas congressman and one-time presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke said the shooting was a reflection of the state's lax gun control measures. Quote, "Our representatives in Texas have left us open to these kinds of attacks," he tweeted. "Time to change our representatives," end quote. Gun control activists called out the rate of firearm-related homicides and suicides in Texas, which ranks in the middle of the pack nationally for gun deaths, according to federal data. Quote, "If more guns and fewer gun laws made Texas safer, it would be the safest state in the U.S., tweeted Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Action. Instead, it has high rates of gun suicide and homicide and is home to 4 of the 10 deadliest mass shootings," end quote. The shooter, whom authorities identified as 43-year-old Keith Thomas Kanunen, fatally shot 2 members of the church's volunteer security team, both men in their 60s, during the Sunday service before Wilson fired back at him, officials said. During a vigil Monday evening, Senior Minister Brett Farmer said he had encountered Kanunin at the church before. Quote, "I had seen him. I had visited with him. I had given him food. I had offered him food at other occasions he had been to our building," he said. A video of the attack, captured by the church's live stream camera, shows the gunman sitting in a pew during the service before the shooting. He stands up and paces briefly before he speaks to another churchgoer and pulls a large gun from his coat at about 10:50 a.m. He then fires toward the man he spoke to, striking him and another man standing nearby as other congregants scream and dive beneath the pews. The video then shows a fourth man, apparently Wilson, shoot the gunman. At least four congregants with weapons raised rushed toward the attacker, who had fallen to the ground. The two victims were taken to a hospital, but soon died of their injuries. The Texas Department of Public Safety identified the men as Anton Wallace, age 64, of Fort Worth, and Richard White, age 67, of River Oaks. Quote, "We have lost some great men, but so many other lives could have been lost," Farmer said at the vigil Monday. "I love this community. I love this church. I love this state, and I love our country, and I love our freedoms. And I'm not going to let evil take that away," end quote. Footage of the shooting has been removed from the church YouTube page, though it continues to circulate through social media platforms. The FBI is working with local and state authorities to investigate the shooting. Paxton said investigators are uncertain of the gunman's motive and are searching for people who knew the shooter. Kanunin, who had previous arrests for alleged assault, theft, and possession of an illegal weapon, appeared to be, quote, "more of a loner," end quote. It is probably going to be very difficult to determine what his motivations were, other than maybe mental illness, Paxton said. Authorities say Kanunin may have been transient and might have visited the church several times. Quote, "Unfortunately, this country has seen so many of these that we've actually gotten used to it at this point," Jeff Williams, the regional director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, told reporters Monday. Continuing the quote, "It's tragic, and it's a terrible situation, especially during the holiday season," end quote. A spokesperson for the West Freeway Church of Christ and Farmer's family declined Monday to address the church's security practices. It is unclear whether the church screens people who carry guns into the building. Farmer recently self-published a work of fiction set in the Texas Hill Country about an attack on the United States by Muslim terrorists, an event he writes in the book's introduction that he hopes, quote, "never comes to pass, but there is always that possibility," end quote. As the story begins, a group of Texas ranchers worry forebodingly about the presence of terrorists in the United States. Later, as an Islamic State flag is hoisted atop the Empire State Building, they are glad to have stockpiled guns and ammunition. Quote, "guns needed now," the main character thinks, as the crisis gets underway. Before the new law, gun owners in Texas could not carry weapons into a house of worship without specific authorization from church leadership. The Sutherland Springs attack spurred Texas lawmakers and a Republican-controlled legislature to loosen the state's gun laws so that they could do so more easily. While there is no specific law that allows armed volunteers in places of worship, members of a congregation can use their concealed carry license to protect their religious community, said South Texas College of Law at Houston professor Josh Blackman. Houses of worship and other businesses in Texas are still legally authorized to ban firearms on their premises. But in September, another law went into effect requiring a house of worship to post a sign stating it is opting out before it can prohibit licensed individuals from carrying weapons inside. Conservative politicians and gun rights advocates credited the looser gun laws with saving lives. Quote, "The brave officers from the White Settlement Police Department were on the scene in less than 2 minutes, but these men who had volunteered for the church security team had already secured their church," Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, a Republican, said in a statement. The National Rifle Association renewed its Good Guy with a Gun defense of looser firearms restrictions in a Sunday tweet praising the armed churchgoers' actions, a defense that gun control group Newtown Action Alliance called a myth, noting that Wilson was highly trained. Senator Ted Cruz, a Republican from Texas, and Texas Governor Greg Abbott, also a Republican, praised the armed response. Paxton added Monday, quote, "We can't prevent every incident, we can't prevent mental illness from occurring, and we can't prevent every crazy person from pulling a gun. But you can be prepared like this church was," end quote. Paul reported from New York, and Belware reported from Chicago. Alex Horton and Alice Kreitz in Washington contributed to this story. This story was first published by the Texas Tribune. The Texas Tribune is proud to celebrate 10 years of exceptional journalism for an exceptional state. This is the medical advice column To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Dear Dr. Roach, I have heard that fish oil can clog the arteries and cause problems, but I've also heard it's good to take. I don't know if it is good or bad. Can you help me out with this? Answer. There remains controversy about fish oil, but recent studies prompted the U.S. Food and Drug Administration Advisory Committee to recommend wider use of a prescription fish oil. These new studies show that icosapent ethyl, VASEPA, a highly purified fish oil ester, reduced the risk of cardiovascular events by 5% and lowered the risk of cardiovascular death by 0.9% in people with high triglycerides, known coronary artery disease, diabetes, and at least one other risk factor, despite the use of statin drugs. For people with higher than average risk of heart disease and high triglycerides despite statin therapy, I believe fish oil or fish oil-based pharmaceuticals has a role to play in reducing the risk of heart attack, stroke, and death that will be further revealed in the next few years. OHS student headed for Congress state attorney. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. For the second year in a row, Odessa High School senior Karis Cox will be participating in the Congress State Tournament at the University of Texas at Austin. The tournament lasts from January 13th through January 15th. Karis's father, speech, debate, and theater teacher Aaron Cox, said his daughter is the only one from ECISD who qualified for the state proceedings. The first two rounds will be at UT Austin. If she makes the finals, it will take place in the state capitol, where legislators actually debate and using the furniture lawmakers use, Aaron Cox said. With student Congress, participants write bills and send them in. A certain amount are approved or not. Quote, "They have to go through the writing process, the research process. They have to tell all the stuff of why this bill needs to be done, so then you get to do research. During the contest, you have legislators who get up for the bill. They talk about it. They take questions. Then you get someone against the bill. Then they get questions," Aaron Cox said. It's all done in a compressed time period. This will be the eighth year that OHS has participated in the Congress State Tournament. Aaron Cox said one of the best things he heard was that a lawmaker said the students could teach the legislators how to do their jobs. He said there was no childishness. Quote, "It was all about the bill, business about the bill, and then moving on," Aaron Cox said. To qualify for the state tournament, he said you have to compete in your region in various classifications. Aaron Cox said that Karras tangled with students from Lee High School in Midland and Permian High School. She came in second, sandwiched by Lee in first and third. Quote, "It's really odd for the students because she was competing also against 3A, but 3A didn't have any impact on her going to state, so she was still questioned by people who had no impact on their going or not, so she had to be good at answering those questions. She had to be able to have the knowledge and the research that she had in her speech to be able to answer questions and to support why she was for and against the bills," Aaron Cox said. Karras will have a chance to make nationals in speech and debate, and she'll also compete in the International Thespian Festival at Indiana University in Bloomington in June. Aaron Cox said Karras has been able to accomplish a lot in a short period of time. He said she's not always happy that he has had her work so hard, but he has all his students participate in the Congress State Tournament because of the research and speaking skills that it teaches. Quote, "It gets them actually ready for the real world, and it gets them ready for college. Both my daughters have made it to state Congress," Aaron Cox said. Continuing the quote, "The accomplishments never cease to amaze that both my girls are smarter than I am and more talented," end quote. His oldest daughter is Kennedy Hernandez. He added that student Congress is one of the best things teachers can give a student because it enables them to defend both sides of an argument and gives them a more well-rounded picture of the world. For her part, Karras Cox, age 17, said going to state in the Congress tournament is pretty cool. Quote, "I'm excited to go look at the University of Texas again and hopefully, possibly, make it to the finals round where you can compete at the state capitol," Karras Cox said. She said it is easier the second time around only because she knows how things run now, but it's not any easier competition-wise. Quote, "I've been writing two speeches in 0 hour. Then I'll write two speeches on my lunch period and then two more speeches after school so I can get all 40 done. It's a lot of work, and a lot of them it's pretty hard to really decide whether or not you want to affirm what exactly the bill says or negate what the bill says," Karras Cox said. Quote, "I feel like I have definitely grown as a speaker and grown as a student because I'm taking dual credit classes, so I've been able to better research my papers and understand exactly what's happening in the status quo," she added. She's also excited to be going to nationals in theater again. Quote, "I made so many friends. I got to work with so many professionals. It's going to be a really good experience to be able to go again," Karras Cox said. Her preference is to earn a musical theater degree in Los Angeles. Mother, daughters enjoy sharing career paths at MCH. The story was written by Royal McGregor. After spending roughly 20 years as a nurse in the neonatal intensive care unit at the University of Tennessee Medical Center in Knoxville, Tennessee, Tammy Watson decided to retire. That retirement didn't last very long. During her second travel nursing assignment, Watson found herself in Odessa, and Medical Center Hospital had an open position as the unit director of the NICU and pediatrics. Watson applied for the position, was offered the job, accepted it, moved nearly 1,200 miles from Knoxville to Odessa, and has held that position at MCH for the last 6.5 years. Quote, "This job was open, and I liked it here," Watson said. "I applied and got it. I'm one of those long-termers. I don't tend to leave," end quote. About 4 years after Watson moved, her eldest daughter also made a home in Odessa. Jennifer Stevens, age 38, with her husband and 4 children, relocated to Odessa in March of 2017, and about 1.5 years later, Watson's second and final daughter, 34-year-old Julie Watson, moved to the West Texas city. Both of Tammy Watson's daughters followed in her footsteps to MCH. Stevens works as a paramedic in the emergency room, and Julie Watson is a unit clerk for labor and delivery. Quote, "I've had the opportunity to come and work in my mother's unit when she's short-staffed," Stevens said. "It has been a great experience for me. I've gotten to know a lot of directors and gotten a really cool around-the-hospital experience being able to work in different areas," end quote. Tammy Watson says it's a unique experience to plan family events as all three are at MCH at different times. Stevens works the day shift on the weekends, while Julie Watson works nights. Tammy Watson is scheduled Monday through Friday. Quote, "We manage especially since Stevens and Julie Watson work on opposite shifts," said Tammy Watson. Quote, "We all really love the hospital. It's very family-friendly, and the support that you get from the executive team and the directors are phenomenal, and that's why I stayed," end quote. Though the trio rarely spend time at MCH together, the three logged emotionally draining hours at the hospital August 31st after the mass shooting shocked Odessa when a 36-year-old gunman shot and killed 7 people and left 25 others injured. Stevens was working in the emergency room as the first wave of patients came to MCH. The hospital received 14 patients, while Odessa Regional Medical Center and Midland Memorial each had 6. Tammy Watson drove in and spent time at the hospital's reunification center, while Julie Watson came in for her night shift. Quote, "It was extremely emotionally draining, but being in this profession, you always think of your patients and their family first," Tammy Watson said. "That's what you are trained to do, and that's your personality. That's all we were thinking about, is taking care of those patients and those families. By the time I went home that night, I was emotionally whipped. I was totally drained, but had that good feeling that we did the best we could and helped the families," end quote. Stevens remembers during her shift it was all business, but a switch flipped when she got home. She said she spent the rest of the night lying in bed with her husband and children. As Stevens, her mother and sister went through the same experiences on August 31st, Stevens said there's an understanding between the trio that each will talk about their emotions when they are ready. Quote, "I find it really wonderful being part of a medical family, because if I'm having a bad day at work, my husband does push me, my mom doesn't push me," Stevens said. "When I'm ready to talk, I'll say something," end quote. Tammy Watson said the ability to flip the switch from family members to colleague is a seamless transition. The trio can be interacting as mother and daughters or as sisters, but when they arrive at work or come out of the lunchroom at the hospital, the three turn back into colleagues. Quote, "We go to lunch together, and we sit and laugh and have a good time, but then we go back to the serious part," Tammy Watson said. Continuing to quote, "If there's something odd going on, I might go down and help them. If there's something crazy going on in pediatrics, she will come up there. We are still able to work well together," End quote. In 1993, Tommy Watson graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Nursing degree from the University of Tennessee. She continued to push the importance of education to her two daughters, even though it wasn't met with immediate success. Watson said she kept planting the seed about the possibility of earning college degrees. Julie Watson and Stevens finally took the bait and are both attending Odessa College. Stevens is expected to graduate in December and then start her master's program immediately following. Julie Watson is taking her basics at Odessa College, but will plan on transferring to Midland College for respiratory therapy. Quote, "My mother kept telling me to go to nurse, but I was stubborn, and it took me a while," said Stevens, who worked as a paramedic for 16 years. Quote, "When I told her that I was going to nursing school, she said, 'It's about time.'" End quote.
That's the end of the first hour of the Midland Reporter Telegram and Odessa American. We'll begin our second hour right after we take a look at weather.